Welcome to the CSIS podcast. I'm Colm Quinn. And so, the Iran Nuclear Agreement, or JCPOA, joins the Paris Climate Accord and the Trans-Pacific Partnership as another Obama-era deal that will not fly with the Trump administration.
I am announcing today that the United States will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal.
Much like those other deals, the world plans to go on without the U.S. Indeed, Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel questioned whether America's security partnership with Europe is worth counting on, saying, It's no longer the case that the United States will simply just protect us. Rather, Europe needs to take its fate into its own hands. Today, we'll be discussing the fallout from Trump's announcement. And joining me is Heather Connolly, a senior vice president at CSIS and director of our Europe program, as well as John Alterman. He's also a senior vice president and directs our Middle East program. The decision for the U.S. to abandon the Iran deal has a huge effect on our allies. President Macron, Chancellor Merkel came to D.C. trying to lobby the president, trying to get him to change his mind. That didn't happen. That's a bit embarrassing for them.
Yeah, it has been a tough week for the EU, for the EU3, as we like to call them, the United Kingdom, Germany, and France. Let's just step back for a minute. The Europeans have been working on this, the Iran sanctions package, and ultimately the agreement for 12 years. And in some ways, Europe is what brought Iran really to the negotiating table after they imposed the toughest sanctions on oil. And that was really, I think, a key to getting the parties to the table. They worked very hard to fulfill the president's admonition to fix the deal, or he would nix the deal. And so when President Macron came here for the state visit, he presented a fix, which was to build on the nuclear agreement, to look at the ballistic missile defense program, to look at the regional behavior. And France has been actually incredibly tough on this issue vis-a-vis Iran, nothing to be to shy away from. So they presented the fix, and the president still walked away from it. And not only for their efforts to try to fix it, now the Europeans are going to bear a lot of costs of the sanctions reimposition and secondary sanctions, which will harm Europe's economy. So they tried, and now they're going to get hit economically. We don't know where we go from here. The rest of the parties to the agreement are going to be meeting. So you're going to have the visual of the UK, France, and Germany meeting with Russia, China, and Iran to see what is left of this deal. That's not a good visual. It isolates the U.S. We don't know where this proceeds forward. And you have, again, those three leaders, Theresa May, Emmanuel Macron, Angela Merkel, they were not in opposition to the president. They were trying to work towards making this better. And they just got told, nope, that's not what we're going to do. So it's a real question mark about if Europe starts thinking about counter sanctions, if they start saying, look, we can't work with this president if we've tried and he just goes and does whatever he wants to do anyway.
Well, it's interesting. On one side, we have the European allies kind of put out, but in the Middle East, Israel, Saudi Arabia seem to have got what they want, John.
Well, and these are in Israel and Saudi Arabia have two governments that have a strategic approach of trying to build a very close personal relationship with President Trump. Prime Minister Netanyahu has really tried to make a close relationship, and arguably it's paid off. The Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, has also made a personal relationship with the president. His core strategic objective, and for whatever their governments think, and there's a lot of evidence that the technocrats in the Israeli government are quite alarmed by the prospect of the JCPOA collapsing. On a political level, these individuals are committed to building a relationship with President Trump and came out very clearly and said, the president has it exactly right.
I want to talk to the prospect of U.S. credibility here. There's a lot of people saying that, this is this is really damaging. And I mean, I'm not sure because the U.S. has pulled out of a lot of deals so far. This is kind of another end. So when you look at, say, maybe renegotiating another deal or coming back to the table, do you think that the U.S. has lost that credibility to be able to do something, at least within this administration, when it comes to Iran?
I think U.S. administrations going back almost 20 years, what we end up doing, the president who is elected works very hard to undo what the last president just did. That was President Bush under Clinton, Kyoto, and then President Obama undoing what President Bush did, and then President Trump undoing what President Obama did. This is where we lack credibility because we don't have bipartisan support for what we're trying to achieve. The reason this is an agreement or an action plan, it should have been a treaty. There should have been democratic support, and then there's permanence to that. But we don't have that anymore. So I think, of course, President Trump has done damage to U.S. credibility, but I think that was wearing thin for quite a while when there is no bipartisanship in our foreign and security policy. It's going to get changed every 4 to 8 years. And I sort of wonder whether governments are going to say, you know, in TPP, out of TPP. Why is it worth negotiating with the U.S. if they're just going to undo what they've just done?
As Heather points out, we had a long tradition that politics ends at the water's edge. And when you start dealing with foreign affairs, foreign policy, there shouldn't be partisan differences. And clearly, we are in a space where not only do you have segments of a party who oppose international agreements or oppose the UN or something like that, or oppose trade agreements, it feels much more that it's not even about the issues. It's about the idea of bipartisanship in foreign policy is floating away, which does create this sort of volatility in the US view. I think there's something else particular to this administration, which is it's very hard to be an ally of the United States right now. Because the president thinks that unpredictability gives him power, and the president believes that bilateral negotiations with states are much better than being part of this multilateral system. Well, the unpredictability means your friends have a harder time figuring out where you're going, so it's hard to help you. And the bilateral piece means that all of our friends feel that they're in an adversarial relationship with a stronger power instead of aligned with a stronger power to do something together. And it seems to me that not only for Europe, but for Asia as well, trying to figure out how can we go somewhere together with the United States to get off an adversarial footing when the president seems to want to preserve his route of action and be in an adversarial footing with the very people who think, no, we're your wingman.
And Heather, this isn't the first time that Europe and the U.S. have diverged. I think the most famous time was probably the Iraq War, the Freedom Fries and old Europe. Do you see it going in that direction?
So this is where I think the difference between 2003, you really did have Jacques Chirac and Gerhard Schroeder very much in opposition of President Bush at that time. In this case, you had Emmanuel Macron and Angela Merkel trying to help the president improve the deal. That, to me, was the real difference. They weren't. They obviously opposed the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA, but they were trying to work with us. In 2003, there was just absolute opposition, and there was real tension. The question is now, where does Europe go from here with this? There's lots of discussion about we will stay in the agreement, but they know that there's really now the huge question if the agreement even stands. The reimposition of U.S. sanctions will really impact Europe. Airbus next week is going to have to decide whether they're going to continue to invest in Iran or they are going to have to choose the U.S. as their market of choice. So I just think, and we also have a June 1st deadline looming that, you know, the Trump administration may impose steel and aluminum sanctions against the EU. I mean, the hits just keep coming. And absolutely to John's point, you know, allies are an amplification of American power. That's what U.S. leadership through these multilateral alliance structures and things like that, that's it improves our power. Right now, it is really true. America first is America alone. We are alone now. We don't have our allies and partners helping achieve our objectives. Now they're going to be trying to sort out if they're going to be working in opposition to us. And that's exactly the last place we want to be.
Well, and the other piece, as you suggested before, Europe's been working on an Iran deal for 12 years. And the idea that what's at stake here is not just the deal. The question is, can you negotiate to improve things? Are you willing to compromise in order to reach a larger goal? Europe, having experienced war in the middle of the 20th century, is committed to the idea of avoiding war and trying to compromise and trying to bring people together, and that international law and inspections and then verification can get you to a better place. The Trump administration is of the view that that shows weakness, and the way to lead is to tell people exactly where they're going and then to go there and people will follow you. And Europe has a whole series of decisions to make about whether, given this different American approach, will Europe say, well, the United States has tremendous leverage and influence, and we're going to follow the United States and try to bring them around slowly, or whether Europe is going to try to find ways to work in opposition. My own judgment is not only for Europe, but countries in Asia, countries like China. There are a whole series of things we want from China. The things we're going to want European support as we try to unwind the Syria war. But for China, if we're going to do North Korea, if we're going to do trade, if we're going to do a whole series of things, you need some modicum of cooperation with the Chinese. And you have to decide, what are we going to fight about and what are we going to agree about? And it feels to me like the Trump administration is experimenting with the idea of shock and awe will bring the Chinese into line. And I don't think the Chinese feel as vulnerable as a shock and awe approach would merit.
So we have two important milestones. We'll have the Group of Seven, the G7 meeting in Canada in early June, June 6th and 7th, when President Trump will be sitting across the table again from Chancellor Merkel and Emmanuel Macron, the EU, Japan. That is going to be a difficult conversation. That's a meeting of the like-minded to try to move this forward. It's very unclear whether that's vis-a-vis North Korea or Iran, what that's going to be. Then the president travels to Europe in mid-July for a NATO summit in Brussels. He'll be visiting London for a working visit. This gets tougher and tougher, and these should be the easy visits. The allies should be the easy part of your portfolio. That is how we can work together to get stuff done. The hard stuff is going into the adversaries and addressing them. Unpredictability is a tool for adversaries. It undercuts allies. And we just, I don't know, John, I think from the Europeans, here's the challenge. Yes, they will try to say, they know they have to now do things on their own. Angela Merkel has said that now. Look, we're on our own, friends. The U.S. is going in a different direction. But they know they cannot do things by themselves without the U.S. We are too interlinked economically, and their security depends on our security posture. They are really going to be stuck in both supportive and adversarial at the same time, which means they can't play their role either.
Well, as you point out, I think it's a very important point. It's not only that allies are a force multiplier, but if you're not going to work with your allies, then there are a lot of things that aren't going to get done. The U.S. has limited bandwidth. The U.S. in many ways is trying to focus more on key objectives. One of the things we saw in the National Defense Strategy is a much narrower focus on what the U.S. is going to pay attention to in the world. Europe, partly because the EU operates by consensus, there's a real limit to what Europe can lead on and how it can lead and how effectively it can lead. I think as we look forward to the next several years, we are not only looking at losing the allies as a force multiplier, but we're also looking at a complex world where a lot of things are just going to go undone.
I thought it was interesting in Trump's speech about the Iran deal, he mentioned that Mike Pompeo was on his way to North Korea to speak with the Kim regime. Is there kind of a perverse logic coming into this that if you're Iran, this has just happened to you, you might take the logic, you might follow the logic to the point that if we want the US to take us seriously, maybe we do need to get a nuclear bomb. Maybe we need to be more serious about getting to that.
Well, I think it is the parallels of the U.S. is withdrawing from the Iran deal and simultaneously trying to basically create a very similar perspective with Pyongyang, meaning that there's going to have to be an agreement where we see steps and transparency taken for denuclearization, and we'll have to see what that agreement is. That, you know, confidence in one, what happens when President Trump's successor says, that was a terrible deal that Donald Trump negotiated, I'm going to rip that up. You know, that's, again, that credibility over the long term. Can you have confidence that there's durability to this agreement? I was struck the other week when National Security Advisor John Bolton publicly said that this is going to be like the Libya arrangement, where it's instantaneous, immediate denuclearization. You know, I think for many leaders, the Libya example and then what happened to Muammar Gaddafi in 2011 is actually the opposite example, that when you don't have nuclear-capable forces, then you are susceptible to regime change. That is the ultimate regime survival tool, if you will. So I found that was an interesting way of thinking about it. So this is going to be really, really hard. It's going to be hard doing it by ourselves. If we don't have allies working together with us that have to help us with the verification and help us with, you know, the assistance that will be probably part of any agreement for denuclearization. We have a horrible history that goes back two decades of doing this with North Korea. They promise, they don't deliver again and again and again. So, again, it strikes me that we can so compartmentalize this. They're all interwoven, and every leader watches what is happening in the other place, and they make their determination from there.
And there aren't a lot of happy stories about countries that gave up their nuclear
programs.
Ukraine? There are happy stories about countries that toughed it out, whether it's Israel or India or Pakistan, where the U.S. came to accept the nuclear program. So the historical parallels are not very good. And if you think that Libya is your model, then you need to ask Muammar Gaddafi how well that worked for him. And that's hard to do.
And how well it worked for Libya.
Right. Well, and Ukraine, been given security guarantees by Russia. And then later, now Russia holds in some way 7% of Ukrainian territory. Yes, that's not, the history does not demonstrate this is a good lesson to learn.
So, John, I want to turn to Iran and how this is actually going to play internally. Rouhani had kind of bet his reputation on this deal. Does this now make him weaker? Does this now give hardliners in the country a boost? What's the effect then going to happen in the country?
Well, it's certainly not a win, because he predicted that this would have a more positive effect. I don't think it's game over either. What I would expect the Iranians to do is to try to use this as a wedge between the United States and its allies. Because what brought Iran to the table was the United States and the EU3, plus Russia and China, being so disturbed by Iranian actions, by President Ahmadinejad, that they act together and really put the screws to the Iranian economy. I think the best alternative that Rouhani has now is to try to split the United States off from its allies, to certainly deepen ties with Asia. You're going to see the Chinese deepening their ties with Iran, which partly serves their goals of expanding into Asia and having alternatives to Western energy supplies. It helps their Belt and Road Initiative. It helps undermine American hegemony in the world. So that's a big win for the Iranians and for the Chinese. I think you're going to see the Indians deepen their ties, notwithstanding a desire for closer U.S.-Indian ties. But I think the Indians have their own view of this. The Iranians will have options, and I think they'll try to work more deeply with the Europeans, they will say, look, we're the victims, because everybody agrees that we were adhering to the agreement, we're allowing the inspections, all those things. So aren't you going to stand up for rule of law? On the fringes, you'll see the Iranians playing their proxy games. They've been playing proxy games in Yemen and in Syria. I think you're going to see more of that. They're going to try to send a message first that they're not intimidated. But second, to remind everybody that Iran does have the opportunity to make mischief. And the way to get Iran not to make mischief is to try to work with the Iranians. And I think, frankly, it's going to be partly successful. Now, Rouhani has his own internal challenges. There certainly are people who said, this will never work. The United States is a deep and hostile opponent, and we told you it wouldn't work, and now it doesn't work. But I don't think Rouhani ever thought the United States was a friend. I don't think he ever thought the United States was going to be a friend. I think he always was skeptical. I think he is a terrific both political strategist and tactician. And I would not begin to count him out in Iran for internal Iranian politics. I think he's going to try to pivot and demonstrate that Iran can survive even without the United States, and that the longer-term consequences of creating alternative structures to working through the U.S. financial system, of creating more robust alternatives to dollar-denominated oil sales, I mean, that could really be a game changer for U.S. power in the world in 5 or 10 years' time, and we may be seeing the beginning of that transition.
Finally, one of the immediate knock-on effects of Trump pulling out of the deal, it seemed, was Israel and Iran trading rocket fire, not through proxies, the actual Iranian government forces. Does it worry you that this could escalate?
Well, it certainly could escalate, but it seems to me that everybody's been relatively restrained. You could argue that what the Iranians did was to send a limited salvo, not into Israel itself, but into what the Iranians see as the Israeli occupied Golan Heights. There weren't a lot of Iranian casualties from the Israeli strikes. I've seen reports of up to 70 targets, but with 70 targets, you could have a lot of casualties, and there weren't a lot of casualties. So it seems to me that Iran wanted to send a message that we have options. Israel want to send a message saying, if it rains here, it's going to flood where you are. I think the Iranians will look for something more ambiguous, more deniable, with less clear attribution to try to, you know, keep people aware that they're not surrendering. But I don't think either side really wants a big escalation this summer. There may be an escalation. Hezbollah is strengthening. Hezbollah has lots of missiles that it can rain down on Israel, and they can reach all of Israel. But my instinct is Iran's strategic goal over the summer is going to be showing that it's a responsible party rather than a radical one. They're going to want to deepen their ties with Europe. They're going to want to deepen their ties with China. They have their own problems inside Syria with Russia, which, by the way, didn't use its anti-aircraft batteries against the Israeli strike, which has to worry the Iranians a little bit. So I think they have other things to do, and they're going to try to find a way to de-escalate rather than escalate with no sense of where this is going.
And that brings us to the end of another CSIS podcast. Thanks to John Alterman and Heather Connolly for joining me, and thanks again to Yumi Araki for producing this episode. We will be back again next week with more. In the meantime, you can continue to get in touch with me via email, cquinn@csis.org, and on Twitter. Until then, I'm Colm Quinn. Thanks for listening.